Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. The holiday season in Louisiana is filled with religious and cultural tradition. For those of the Jewish faith, December brings 8 nights of Hanukkah celebrations when families gather together to light the menorah, exchange gifts, and feast on traditional foods. On this week's Louisiana Eats, Rabbi Cohn shares childhood memories of Hanukkah and reflects on his many years spent at Temple Sinai, Louisiana's largest synagogue. Then, gourmet kosher chef Elizabeth Kurtz illustrates how the holidays are the perfect time to say, "I love you," with home-cooked meals that warm the heart and fill your tummy. And of course, any holiday celebration has to end with something sweet. In Louisiana, it's a safe bet that pralines are always part of the sweets selection. No one knows pralines better than the Stokes family of Leah's Pralines. We'll visit their French Quarter shop and also hear the surprising history of the praline from culinary historian Ryan Fertel. We're having one sweet celebration on this week's Louisiana Eats. Hanukkah is often called the Festival of Lights, a name that brings together the spiritual and the gastronomical. In order to illuminate this connection, we went to Temple Sinai to visit with Rabbi Ed Cohn, who's the spiritual leader of the largest synagogue in Louisiana. In preparation for the 8 nights, we spoke with Rabbi Cohn about his experiences at Temple Sinai and his favorite Hanukkah food traditions.
Well, Hanukkah is not officially a major Jewish festival of Judaism. I say officially, because it wasn't designed to be. But in modernity, it came for many reasons to be one of the favorite times of celebration in the Jewish world. And so we can say that it is a major holiday now. There are a lot of children who are looking very much forward to receiving their gifts on the 8 nights of Hanukkah, and a lot of adults who I think get even more pleasure from presenting them. The synagogue is not the center, but the home is the center of celebration for Hanukkah.
When we talk about celebrating Hanukkah, I suppose that the potato latke is the big food that you will find on Hanukkah tables across the world. Tell us the importance. What's the origin?
Well, for that, we have to go back to the historic basis of the holiday. The holiday is based on the war that was fought by the Hasmoneans, the Maccabees, and the success that they had in 165 before the Common Era, or BC, in overcoming the Assyrian Greeks, who had insisted that Jews give up their way of worship and adopt Greek customs that were antithetical, totally against Jewish practice. So the good guys, the Maccabees, won, and they went into the ancient temple that had been defiled, and according to the story in the Talmud, in one little paragraph, it talks about the miracle of the lights. They could not find enough oil to keep the 7-branch candelabra lit for more than a day, and according to tradition, it lasted for 8 days, giving them sufficient time to get more pure oil. So because of the oil, things that were cooked in oil became customary at Hanukkah time. In the German world, potato pancakes were really big, and those are latkes. And it is a passion on the part of most Jews to find at this time of the year the most precious latke, the best latke. People have different ideas. Some people like crisp ones, all crisp. Some like kind of gooey latkes where the potato is really gooey and it's not really that crisp. Typically, I like the edges to be crisp and the center to be kind of soft. And they're cooked in oil. It's a time when you take probably two cholesterol drugs at night. You dip this potato pancake in either applesauce or sour cream. Pure sour cream, none of that half-fat stuff. Also, jelly donuts, fried donuts filled with jelly coming from Israel. And people usually serve the brisket alongside the potato pancake.
I didn't know about the jelly donuts. Tell me a little bit more about that.
It's an Israeli contribution. The Israelis will, at that time of the year, will serve these little round pastries, all fried, you know, typical of a donut, a jelly-filled donut. There's very little in Jewish dietary life which is calorically lean. We really do a job on ourselves. But if one just eats Jewish, you will probably gain weight.
Where are you from, Rabbi?
My home was a little town outside of Baltimore called Glen Burnie, between Baltimore and Annapolis. My grandparents settled there. To this day, the only Jewish family in Glen Burnie, the Cohn family.
Well, amazing. And from that one Jewish family came Rabbi Cohn. When did you know that that was the life path you wanted to follow?
By the time I was 10. I had built a synagogue in my basement and had a little ark there with a miniature Torah that's kind of behind me on the shelf. And I conducted services for my grandmother who would come, and all my friends were non-Jewish since, you know, and they would all come over and come to the synagogue in Eddie's basement. And then one night I forgot to put the little votive light out that was the eternal light that is traditionally above the ark, and it burned the ceiling of our basement. After that, it had to be an electric eternal light. But I knew where I wanted to be. It was a great blessing growing up in the late 50s and in the 60s when everybody was trying to find themselves and all that. I knew, so I immediately went from high school to our seminary so that I was ordained. I was 25 years old when I was ordained.
Well, I love the idea of your little synagogue in the basement. When you think back of your family life there, do you have any great food memories from your childhood?
Well, my mother was a great cook. Growing up in our house was like having a Harriet and Ozzie Nelson. I mean, my mother baked every day. She would bake cookies and brownies and cakes that she iced. And we always had them there. And she would make pierogin, which is kind of a Russian-Polish pastry of dough that you would have to, like, made of Bisquick. And she would grind up beef and onions and add some chicken schmaltz to it and bake these things. And they looked like little torpedoes. And they were so delicious. And, you know, she would go to the kosher butcher. And since we were in Glen Burnie, that at times was an hour either way, and she would bring with my father. They had kosher meat in our house, and they showed that they really were willing to walk the walk, not just the talk.
Do you have any Hanukkah memories from childhood that really stand out?
Well, you know, that's the funny thing. Having grown up in a town where I was the only Jewish kid, my brother and I, Hanukkah was a spiritual holiday for us. We always lit the menorah. We had a menorah in the window of our home. Very, very proudly Jewish. But come Christmas, we got our gifts. So we never had any Christmas tree or any Christmas decorations or anything like that. It was just that on Christmas Day, I would get all my Hanukkah gifts and they were wrapped in Hanukkah paper. And then I'd always go and decorate the trees, Christmas trees with my Gentile friends.
So you come to New Orleans. How did you happen to come here, Rabbi, and how long ago was that?
We moved here in 1987. I had been here in 1979 we were in Macon, Georgia, my first pulpit. And I had heard of Temple Sinai, the largest synagogue in the state, historic synagogue. Great things have happened here. Well, I came and stood in the sanctuary, and I said to my wife, Andrea, if we ever get a chance, I want to come here. I want to be the rabbi of this temple. And that was 1979. And then in 1987, I got a call from the placement director of rabbis saying, Temple Sinai has been looking for a year for a rabbi, and they haven't found anyone. And would you be interested in applying? I said, not only am I interested in applying, but that's where we're going. And in 2 weeks, that's exactly what happened. It was all set.
Do you remember your first Hanukkah in New Orleans?
Yes. That first year, we had Hanukkah in the cathedral. We took this gigantic, gorgeous Hanukkah menorah, and the Archbishop welcomed us. And we had one night on a Sunday evening, just the evening before they did the caroling on the square. The Mass ended. We brought the menorah in. We sang Hanukkah songs. The cathedral was filled with Catholics and tourists. And that was the beginning of Hanukkah on the Avenue, which we now have with a Hanukkah menorah that was designed by Dr. Arthur Silverman that we use to mark each night of Hanukkah on the Avenue.
What a wonderful tradition.
Well, New Orleans is so rich in interfaith cooperation that goes back many generations, and we're proud to have continued it.
Well, speaking of interfaith, under your leadership here, Temple Sinai has become even more of an inclusive congregation, and you have really broken down a lot of social barriers. For instance, performing interfaith marriages and even involving LGBT congregants. Could you talk to me about that?
Well, Reform Judaism is a very universal kind of interpretation of Judaism. And our banner is one of being a house of prayer for all peoples. We believe that. We practice that. And when I first came here, we announced a sermon titled Adam and Steve. And we've been advocating for gay rights forever. And it's very, very, very important. And it's a battle that has won and will continue to win, despite occasional bumps in the road. But we think it's very, very important. Interfaith marriages. When theology meets endocrinology, endocrinology wins. The hormones will win. And we've got to get out there and we've got to tell people about the joys of Judaism and the love that it teaches. And very often, as a result of interfaith marriages, we save Jews for Judaism. We don't lose them.
So you're going to retire at the end of this year.
And my retirement is going to be, I'm moving to the study right next door. I will still be here 3-4 days a week. There'll be a new senior rabbi in this study, and I will be assisting him or her in helping to continue to make Temple Sinai a citywide institution and to continue the great traditions of the congregation. So it won't be a full time, but by no means will I be leaving what I love the most, and that's being a rabbi, conducting services, life cycle events, and participating, as I love to, with the Human Relations Commission of the city.
Well, thank you, Rabbi. It really is an enormous honor for me. I'm a great fan of yours from a great distance.
Nice. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Well, what a pleasure to be able to visit like this. Thank you. It's a real honor.
Rabbi Cohn of Temple Sinai in New Orleans.
Tip tap toe, happy Hanukkah, around you go. My little latke on your toes. Happy Hanukkah, and around you go. Clap your hands, happy Hanukkah, clap, clap hands. My little strudler on your toes. Happy Hanukkah, and around you go.
For years, the Lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans has suffered from a lack of food resources, despite the influx of restaurants and businesses into other nearby neighborhoods. This fall, the Sankofa Community Development Corporation set out to change all that. With the goal of providing healthy food and supporting community well-being, Sankofa recently opened a weekly market that brings together farmers and producers from the area. On a windy Saturday, along busy St. Claude Avenue, neighborhood residents and New Orleanians from across the city wandered through the market for the first time. Producer Sarah Holtz sent us this postcard.
We have a lot of satsumas, lemons, local greens, all sorts of stuff.
Sweet.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good, and you?
Good.
My name is Rashida Ferdinand. I'm the executive director. We are a community-based organization that really builds on our resources for the needs of the community. We try to bring what's important to improve quality of life in our area. And this market is an important initiative around preventative health, bringing in a normalcy of fresh foods and whole foods, and connecting fresh whole foods to a better quality of life. We've been operating markets since 2008. So we started as a monthly marketplace on Caffin and St. Claude. And we've grown into farmers market and then a mobile farmers market that moves to different community-built spaces, which we still operate. This was a part of a need for development on this major thoroughfare in partnership with NORA through a competition called Lots of Progress. We won usage of the lot, and we wanted to create a market on this lot and erect it to try to stimulate development in the area and bring fresh food here.
Shane Gunter with All Good Farms.
We're selling hydroponically grown microgreens. We have a farm, All Good Farms, in the Lower Ninth Ward, right off of Renee's and North Miro Street down there. So right now we have a little bit of a spicy mix, which has a little bit of arugula, broccoli, kale, radic, your cabbage. And this is a sango radish, which has a nice spicy, peppery flavor. And then a Japanese mustard green over there. I've been farming for a little over close to 10 years now as a hobby. And then for the last 2 years, we've taken it professionally. And I started off a couple years ago growing for restaurants. I had a small little garden in my house. And then just last year, we ramped it up to a large large-scale farm over in the Lower Ninth Ward, therefore. I think a lot of people are excited to have this here in this location.
And
so.
Two satsumas?
No, that's it. That's
both. You're at 220.
My name is Nema Marimi. I am the program's assistant for Sankofa, and so I am starting to head up a kids program to get kids invested in nutrition and vegetables and excited about good health. So that's my primary, that's what I do. Okay, so there's something called Veggie Dollar Program, and so kind of giving incentives for children, and it's like, oh, and look, you have a dollar token. Now you can go into the market and get something for yourself. So it's about bringing more of a community feel to it, right? So it's not just the parents bringing their kids and their kids are tagging along. Their kids are now becoming a part of what this is. Well, it looks like people like it a lot. It's exciting. People just coming up and being able to greet them and stuff. And you can tell they're excited. Several people have said, like, I have had this in my calendar and now I'm here.
Well, I got to go back to work, but I'll be cooking greens for tomorrow.
Oh, all right. That's dip pretty, huh?
Oh, yeah.
As you know that this neighborhood is changing every day. And it seems that there are people that have recently moved to the neighborhood. But definitely, we have our regulars.
One, two.
Six sweet potatoes.
Six sweet potatoes.
Four satsumas.
Four satsumas.
Three bunches of mustard.
I live actually about two blocks away, right on the other side on Rampart and Eganya. My mom and her family have four fourplexes over there, so we almost have like a family compound. We all just relocated here. Never lived in this area before, but we just all decided to move in one of their investment properties and put some more money into the area. Before, I would grocery shop at Winn-Dixie or Walmart, but anything that you guys have, I'll probably be here from now on.
Right.
I love it. I'm so excited for it to open. So I'm really, really glad that it's here and go home and enjoy some nice greens and grapes and just, you know, the fall weather's coming in, so this is the perfect way to bring it in. Bring the fall, usher the fall in with a lot of nice
fresh fruits and vegetables. It's really cool.
Sankofa Fresh Stop Market in the Lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans. A great place to gather your holiday groceries. When we come back from a short break, gourmet kosher chef Elizabeth Kurtz joins us with ideas for heartwarming home cooking this Hanukkah season. Stay tuned. Are you with me now? I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Hanukkah is just one of many Jewish holidays centered around family celebrations in the home. The Hebrew calendar is teeming with holidays that carry their own communal eating traditions. There's even a weekly celebration in Jewish homes, Shabbos. Gourmet kosher chef Elizabeth Kurtz, author of Celebrate, Family, Food, Shabbos, is a wellspring of knowledge about Jewish holiday meals and rituals. We spoke with Elizabeth about her process compiling these practices into a cookbook, as well as her family's own year-round traditions.
So I started writing about 8 years ago. I started my website. It's called gourmetkoshercooking.com. Even then, I'd wanted to write a book. And when I saw what was going on online, like the explosion of food websites and the explosion of television shows, I said, there's nothing out there in the kosher world. So literally on a whim, I started a kosher website and started posting recipes and reaching out to different people. And right away, it took off. And through my readership, I was able to connect to the Jerusalem Post and quite a few other Jewish publications who took some of my food articles and my food columns and have been publishing them and posting them for quite a few years now.
Well, congratulations with that.
Thank you.
One of your main focuses, or the main focus of the book, really is that very special family tradition that those in the Jewish faith keep. Tell us about Shabbos.
So Shabbos is like really a time that at the end of a busy week, we all put our phones down, we all turn off our computers, we turn off that other part of our engaged life, and we come together as a family and we sit and have a meal, whether it's with our immediate family, our extended family, or with friends. And we really make the meal about a love of family, a love of a higher being, if you believe in one, and a love of life together. But I found that part of giving love to my family was being inspired and bringing something fun and new to the table that I'd prepared for that child or for my husband or for that special guest. So we always say that the joy is that Shabbos comes 52 weeks a year. The challenge is making it delicious every single time.
It's my guess that if we were to make one broad generality, one of the most important things that always appears on the Shabbos table would be challah.
That's right.
I had no idea that anybody could have as many challah recipes as you managed to put in the book.
Well, we have a lot of holidays. I'm telling you, every time I look up, we're getting ready for the next Jewish holiday. So again, it's part of that coming to the table really excited to try new things. And like my kids know that in the fall, I often make the onion poppy seed challah or the pumpkin challah around this time of year, obviously for Thanksgiving, like that Shabbos right after Thanksgiving. We have a gorgeous pumpkin challah on the table. But maybe for Rosh Hashanah in early September usually, where it's a tradition to eat apples and honey and dates, I would make the apples and date challah. And then later in the year, I might make a sweet challah or a water challah. So a lot of our tradition is tied to symbolic food, so we're able to customize even a challah for those times of the year.
One of the fascinating things to me about Jewish cooking, and I I think right now we're seeing this very fascinating trend roll across the United States where Israeli food is becoming the hot new cuisine. Why do you think that is?
As we've, over the last, you know, decade or so, moved towards healthier food, you see food from that region, they have so many healthy ingredients, lots of herbs and spices that are just naturally delicious and super full of flavor, like, you know, sumac and za'atar, and then tahini being infused into salad dressings, and like I even have a tahini cookie in the book. And although there is fat from sesame paste, it's a more natural, healthy way to cook. So I think the combination of the success and the trend setting and maybe just the improvement of their cuisine coupled with the healthy component has made it a place to watch in terms of the cuisine. You know, I happen to love international cuisine in general. So I kind of have been on a mission for the last 15 years or so to try to figure out how to make almost anything kosher. I mean, there are certain foods with certain mouthfeels or certain flavors that are difficult to replicate, but there are so many out there that can be substituted for and use other ingredients that sort of mirror or copy the flavor or the texture that literally makes almost anything kosher.
What was the most challenging thing in that vein you came up with?
So there are certain things that you can't seem to mimic, like calamari. You just can't mimic that kosher. And the other thing that's hard to mimic is bacon, but I've come up with some pastrami, some very thin sliced pastrami, and you can bake it in the oven with a little bit of maple syrup or brown sugar, and you can get like that maple glazed bacon taste without obviously using the pork bacon, which we don't eat in a kosher kitchen. The other thing that's challenging is in a kosher kitchen, we don't mix milk and meat together. So there are some fantastic products out there today, like soy milk or some of the non-dairy sour creams and cream cheeses that act and feel just like the dairy equivalent, but they taste fantastic with certain other flavors added to them. They feel exactly the same in a recipe, and you can make the flavor combination really just come to life.
We're celebrating Hanukkah, and I would really love for you to share with us what Hanukkah is like in your home. Tell us about that particular holiday.
So Hanukkah is amazing because Hanukkah is a time where we like to light the candles right when the sun sets, and we have a full family meal together each and every one of those 8 nights of Hanukkah. And each night, we have like a different Hanukkah food. And that spans the gamut from, of course, potato latkes, but also lots of other foods that are infused with oil. One night, I'll make something like balsamic roasted onion salad. So you have delicious red onions that are roasted in the oven with olive oil and balsamic vinegar, and they're on a terrific green salad with a fantastic balsamic vinaigrette. And lots of variety of latkes. We'll probably do a zucchini latke, a sweet potato latke. This year I've been working on some pulled beef recipes, so we'll do some potato latkes with terrific pulled beef layered on top. So what could be better than that? Pulled beef brisket on top of really yummy fried potato latke.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
And maybe some presents, too.
Maybe some presents, too. Something besides the gelt.
That's right. That's right.
Elizabeth, I'm so grateful to have had this opportunity to talk about the delicious Hanukkah holiday at your home. So please let me wish you the happiest of Hanukkahs for me and all of our friends here at Louisiana Eats.
Thank you so much, Poppy, and wishing you and all your listeners a very, very happy holiday season.
Elizabeth Kurtz, author of Celebrate, Food, Family, Shabbos.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Days of love, days of Hanukkah. Every one of them goes with love.
As you now know, the key element of Hanukkah food is oil, which is why donuts and latke, those yummy fried potato cakes, are most commonly associated with the holiday. I got to thinking about what foods might be right at home on Southern Hanukkah tables, and the thought occurred to me that fried chicken might be a perfect Southern Hanukkah dish, especially if the bird came from a kosher butcher. Once I was thinking outside the box about Hanukkah suppers, I began to think about what drinks might be appropriate. There are many wonderful kosher wines, some that are even made in Israel. But what about a kosher cocktail? Elizabeth Kurtz has a great website, gourmetkoshercooking.com. It's filled with delicious recipes and the stories that she tells so well. There, I found a creation of hers called Spinning Dreidel Rum Punch. For the uninitiated, a dreidel is a little four-sided spinning top with Hebrew letters on each side that provides traditional Hanukkah entertainment for children and adults alike. Elizabeth's rum punch is bound to add some fun to the game. In a punch bowl, she combines rum, vodka, pineapple juice, and a creamy vanilla liqueur that's then refrigerated for about an hour. When it's time to spin the dreidels, Elizabeth adds ginger ale for a little fizz and gets the party started. But be warned, this potent punch might have more than just the dreidels spinning at your house this Hanukkah. For a copy of her recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com and wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, wishing you and yours the happiest of holiday seasons.
Spin that funky dreidel and let the games begin. It's bound to fall on one of each nungimel, hay, or shin. Oh, dreidel, dreidel, dreidel. I made it out of clay.
Two things I always associate with the holidays are celebrating family traditions and indulging in sweet treats. In New Orleans' French Quarter, Leah's Pralines is a quaint family-owned and operated candy shop steeped in a delicious history. Purchased by the glamorous Leah Johnson in 1944, Leah's Pralines boasts the title of oldest candy shop in the Vieux Carré. I stopped into Leah's one rainy afternoon to speak with Elna Stokes and her daughter Susie, who's the third generation to work the family business, and learn more about the Johnson family's history with pralines.
Hi, I'm Elna. I've been running the shop for 31 years. It was my Aunt Leah's shop. Since 1944, it's been in our family in this location.
I'm Susie, Elna's daughter, and I work at the shop every day. I make candy, wait on customers, and do general management stuff.
Well, let's take us back to the start. Explain to me who your Aunt Leah was and how she became so well known for her pralines.
She purchased the shop in 1944, and her goal was to have the best pralines anywhere, and I think that's why she became well known, because quality and taste were what she was going for.
So tell me about this glamorous woman who was your Aunt Leah. You've got some photographs of her here, and in one of them, she's sort of looking like the archetypical businesswoman seated at a desk. And then there's a very, very elegant photo of her in an emerald green long gown.
Back in the day, John Robert Powers was the great modeling school in New York. She was a graduate of that school. And she was truly a glamorous and beautiful woman. And this dress, the long green gown, she was modeling that gown.
Oh, I see. And so that photograph then ends up on your box today.
Right.
So tell me how your product selection and how things have changed here at Leah's Pralines since the time of your great Aunt Leah.
Well, when Aunt Leah ran the shop, she made traditional pralines, which we still use the same recipe. She made the frosted pecans, and they made the pecan brittle, which back then they called pecan flake. And since my mom started running the shop, we added many other things. We have a whole line of chocolates that we make here. We do turtles and chocolate dip brittles and various nut bars. The chocolates are really good. And then We also do a creamy praline, and our creamy praline is really creamy. It's almost like a fudge, but it's really soft and buttery, and that's something that was added later on. And the most popular thing we have that was added fairly recently is our bacon pecan brittle.
Bacon pecan brittle?
It's basically just the pecan brittle recipe, the one that we've been using forever, and then we take bacon and we cut off the fat and we render it, cut it up in small pieces and render it till it's really crispy and just add it to the brittle. And so it basically becomes this like sugar-coated candied bacon with the pecans. And it's really good and it's very popular. I mean, that's probably the traditional pralines and the bacon pecan brittle are our two best sellers right now.
The equipment here, how old or how modern is the equipment? How much of the equipment here was from your Aunt Leah's time?
I know we have copper kettles that are from my aunt, but we also have a candy stove, the round candy stove that was here when I was a little girl.
Would you show it to me?
Sure.
As we entered the shop's kitchen, I could see the staff busy at work, weighing and bagging freshly made pralines. Elna led me over to a corner where her aunt's beautiful old copper kettle sat.
This is incredible back here. It is really exciting. I have never seen a little stovetop like that. It sort of looks like a Victorian crawfish boiler.
Well, it is a candy stove. It's designed to be a candy stove.
In that big copper kettle, about how many pralines or how much brittle will come out of that big copper kettle? And what is the size of it?
It's about 10 inches deep and 21 or 22 inches across. And a batch of pralines
is about 180 pralines. A batch of brittle is about 12 pounds. Now, you could cook more if you had a bigger place to pour the brittle. Uh-huh. But we do make everything in small batches, and we can control the candy better that way.
The table must have come from Aunt Leah as well.
This table has been right here in this spot since I was 12 years old. This marble top, this thing weighs so much, you could never move it.
Explain the importance that the marble makes.
Marble cools the candy. The pralines, we dip on the marble to cool it. The brittle, they pour it on the stainless steel table and stretch it because the stainless steel keeps it hot, so it doesn't cool too quickly. So you can pour it, spread it, stretch it, and then we bring it to the marble, and then that will cool it even more, and then you can bag it. But the brittle, you do have to do quickly because it gets sticky, especially on a really humid day like today. It's raining outside. The brittle will just get very sticky. When it's cooler, it's a little bit easier to work with.
I also want to ask you, what is your favorite childhood memory of growing up here at Leah's Pralines?
Well, you know, I'm struggling to find and remember what would be my favorite because I've spent my whole life here just about it. But, I remember when the parade used to go down Royal Street. And we could just walk out the shop and go watch the parade on the corner of Royal and St. Louis. And that was really fun. I mean, I enjoyed that. And we could also, we lived in this building upstairs on the fourth floor. And we had not a balcony but a rooftop that we could actually see the parades from, you know, just walking outside the apartment, and we could see the parades on the corner.
My favorite time of year in the French Quarter is, you know, Christmas time. Like Royal Street around Christmas when it's cold, oh my gosh, at night, it's so wonderful. Like, I just love that, you know, and it's like I have so many memories of being a kid, like, you know, the Christmas customers and, you know, the holiday bustle in the French Quarter. It was really fun, you know, so that's probably one of my favorite memories.
Elna and Susie Stokes of Leah's Pralines. Have you ever wondered why Louisiana cane fields are often burned before being harvested each fall? Stay tuned, and we'll explain the reasoning behind that process when we come right back. I'm
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. Have you ever wondered why Louisiana cane fields are often burned before being harvested each fall? Farmers burn sugarcane before harvesting to eliminate leafy stalk tops before the cane is cut and delivered to the sugar refineries. That lowers the cost of production and makes harvesting in the fields more efficient. It shortens the amount of time that harvesting takes by almost 10% and increases the yield of the refined sugar as well as the quality. Farmers refer to the process as a prescribed burn, which means that the application of fire takes place in a confined, predetermined area, allowing them to carefully manage the resulting smoke and ash. Take a drive in the country during the month of December, and you're sure to catch a whiff of the Louisiana cane harvest. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Images of 19th century New Orleans are filled with tignon-wearing praline sellers, offering crispy sugar patties from great woven baskets on the streets of the French Quarter. Food historian and scholar Ryan Fertel has done quite a bit of research on the story behind Louisiana's quintessential candy. Ryan's here to offer his theories on the authenticity of those classic images. So, it suddenly, in the 19th century, becomes very prevalent in the lore, and certainly in old woodcuts and imagery. We see that praline cellar again and again, don't we?
We do, especially in histories, in tales of 19th century antebellum New Orleans. However, looking at accounts from the 19th century, there's nothing. There's no accounts of women selling pralines out of baskets before the Civil War.
So when did you see the first accounts of this pralinière in print?
Well, you really start to see them in the 1870s, 1880s. You start to see a lot of traveler accounts in the 1890s. They're describing the streetscape of New Orleans and how it's changed since the war. And it did change a lot. You had African-American women who had more freedom to sell items on the streets. By selling candy, women were able to build a career, build a business. They were able to buy a home. They were able to raise a family.
And I recall you talking about how sometimes they were even playing with their imagery, or they were playing into the imagery. Explain that.
Sure. So the praline cellar or praliniere, it's in all types of histories for the past 150 years of the city. Typically, it's what we'd recognize as the mammy.
Uh-huh.
So the mammy image. So a tignon, it would be a kind of bigger woman in a dress. She would be kind of safe in a way.
Uh-huh.
But these women, because they were business owners selling their recipes on the street, selling their candy on the streets of New Orleans, they were smart enough, they're intelligent enough to play into this imagery, which was prevalent even then. That was being played, that was being sold to tourists and to Southerners immediately after the Civil War. And these women would dress like that. They'd play into the myth. They'd play into the stories being created by white men to sell pralines.
So this imagery, in essence, became a marketing tool for them.
It was a marketing tool, yeah.
So you did all this research, and, you know, you began to find the accounts of the praline sellers, and you had these totally wackadoodle names that you found in history for what they were calling the candy. Would you talk to us about that?
Sure. So if you look at pictures of pralines over the decades, color pictures, you'll see three distinct colors. You'll see the kind of brown or tannish, khaki-colored pralines that we know and see everywhere. Then you see a pink confection, similarly shaped, sometimes a little bit differently, and you'll see a white one too.
And they had special names.
Looking at the picayune, I did a search. You type in the word praline, it's like a Google search, and you get every use of the word praline. So in the 1880s and 1890s, pralines are all over the Picayune. People are talking about them all the time. This is people that work for the Picayune. This is reporters on the street, and these are traveler accounts. Back then, people would, when they'd come to New Orleans, they'd write about it, and they'd send it to the paper. So I found a traveler account from February 1880, a man named Alex Porter Morse. And Alex Porter Morse was from the area, but he had long ago, before the war, moved to Washington, D.C., and he had visited in maybe late 79, early 1880. He hadn't been back in New Orleans for 3 years. And he said that when he visited New Orleans in the late 1870s, that last time, he said it was this wretched place. It was awful. The people were despondent. I mean, it was a just depressed city suffering the effects of the Civil War. But he comes back in late 79, 1880, he publishes this letter, and he says that New Orleans is transformed. He says he doesn't even recognize the city. And he mentions some specific things, and one of them is the street, the scenes from the streets, and he loved to walk the streets. And he said that he saw vendors on the streets for the first time in his life on the streets of New Orleans. He said he saw men selling Italian oranges. He said there were Acadian turkey farmers.
Acadian turkey farmers.
Right, so Cajun turkey farmers. And he said they were marchands, which is the French word for seller, vendor, merchant, of flowers, pralines, white mice, and poodles along Canal Street.
Okay, so white mice and poodles? Like, what's that about?
Okay, well, I think it's important that he kind of separates these three candies. He says there's pralines, white mice, and poodles. I think the white mice were the white praline-shaped candies, those coconut candies. Mice are somewhat praline-shaped, or pralines are somewhat mouse-shaped. So those maybe were the white mice. Maybe that is what they were called in the 19th and early 20th century.
Okay, I'm buying that. And how about the poodle?
All right, poodles. I did a bit of research on poodles, poodle history, poodle culture in 19th century America.
Oh, where food history will lead you, huh?
Right, exactly. So poodles were immensely popular, not so much to own in America in the late 19th century, but they were show dogs, and not in the sense that we know now, but they were kind of circus dogs. They'd be traveling poodle shows. They're dressing up poodles as ballerinas, as school children. They're also painting poodles. They're dyeing the coats of poodles. One of the most popular colors for poodles, of course, was pink.
Yes.
And you'd have show dogs. You'd have troops of traveling pink poodles doing tricks, dancing, walking on two legs, traveling around America. This is a time of P.T. Barnum, of the traveling circus. It's my thought that New Orleanians saw these pink poodles, the cuteness of it, and named this pink candy, this dyed pink candy, after the pink poodle.
Oh, Ryan, I just love your theories. This is delicious and such a sweet story, if I can say so. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Food writer, scholar, and praline detective, Ryan Fertel. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we take a look at what it takes to become a grown-up. Author Kelly Brown talks about a process she calls adulting.
All I had around my house was these piles of clothing, like beanbag chairs, except made of my dirty clothes. And I just thought, whatever you're supposed to be doing, you are not doing it right now. Let's get it together.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef in the French Quarter. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.